Greetings, Strong Tower Radio listeners. My name is Dr. Brian Strayer. I'm a retired history professor from Andrews University in Berrien Springs, Michigan. I have taught Adventist history courses at the elementary, secondary, college, and graduate levels. I have also given hundreds of presentations on dozens of topics related to church history over the past 50 years. During the next several days, I'm going to take you on a virtual tour of several Adventist heritage locations in New York, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and Vermont. In Massachusetts, we will visit Joseph Bates' home, school, and church. In Washington, New Hampshire, we will see the first Adventist chapel, the Cyrus Farnworth House, and Millen Pond, where pioneer baptisms took place even in the midst of winter. In Vernon, Vermont, we will visit Rachel Oakes Preston's house and grave, and the famous Pond Road Chapel, where Rachel heard Dwight L. Moody preach and Ira D. Sankey sing. I hope you will enjoy our time together.
I'm going to tell you about the building real quick. The stoves are not original. They were added in the renovation from 2000 to 2002. The pipes are not original. The stoves come from 1863. They were converted to propane, and they follow the hooks that are original except for maybe one. I think this one here is the only one they had to replace. Those are the original hooks. The roof was should have been shakes, but the fire code does not allow that. They did not want to use asphalt shingles. They wanted to be more period, so they added slate. And if you have a really bright flashlight, you can go up to that door in the balcony, and we ask that you don't go beyond the steps. But you can see the post and beam structure, and those who like building issues, this building is held together with pegs, which is what they did for this. Now, this is a meeting house. We talk about that as being significant. My wife and I went to Andrews University. Her sister still lives by there. That's our alma mater. Some of you may know about it, the Inn from Indiana. And we go to the Center for Adventist Research, and they have a collection of diaries about the Farnsworth diaries. They're just farmer diaries. They're very short. They have things like went to meeting, went to meeting, went to meeting. It wasn't until 1902 we get the first reference to the building being the church. Now, that's a significant change in theology. Why? Well, the church met in the meeting house. That meant you here are the church in the meeting house. And just be aware that when you go to your job, you're the church at work. And when you believe that you're the church, that means you are a witness. The question is whether you're good or bad. Okay, but you are a witness. What we do today is we gather at the church after work and we go witnessing. So this is a big lesson. Now, this building has two doors. It's built in the meeting house style the pilgrims had, but they never had it women with one door, men with the other. That was not done here. The families bought pews. And when you listen to the story, and I don't think we're going to be able to completely tell all these stories about the start of the Sabbath coming here, but the family, we know these two pews here were the William Farnsworth pews. Now, you know, he had 22 kids, but not at the time he paid for the pews, because he had two and he sat on the inside just in front of you, ma'am. That's where he would sit. They did the social meeting. So when you hear the story that Rachel Oakes almost stood up, that was what you did in the social meeting to say you were going to talk, and you sat down when you were done. When you hear those stories that the pastor was preaching on communion about keeping all 10 commandments, she almost got up. That's because back then the pastors did not make the appeal. They followed the Methodist model where a person with the gift of exhortation would come. And he'd say, okay, you've heard the message. What's God been putting on your heart? And the people would make appeals about what God was telling them to do. And I still think that can be a good model. However, there were a lot of people who weren't talking about what God told them to do for themselves. They thought God was telling them what to do for everybody else. And when you hear the story of Ellen White coming here and there were 18 children wanting to get baptized, that's the result of her testimonies. Today, people using her testimonies are driving children out of the church. So we know something's amiss in how we're using them. And so my personal preference is I only use what works for me. And I talk about why it's important to me. And if it helps you, because you're human too, that's great. So the motto here, Washington Still Speaks. This is my wife, Marcia.
Hi, Ken Brawl. She just came from her work.
First week of school. Oh, yes.
She's the church at work.
Yep. Let me tell you about this chart on the wall. Is that okay? All right. In 1863, James and Ellen White were living in Battle Creek, Michigan. They were living there with their three sons. Their oldest son, Henry, was 16 years old. Their middle son, whose name was James, but they called him by his middle name, Edson, was 11 years old. And their youngest son, Willie, was 6 years old. They had lost the baby of the family, Herbert, the year before. He lived to be 4 months old, and he was buried there in the cemetery in Battle Creek. In 1863, James and Ellen White decided they wanted to move back east. There is a book written by Judd Lake, who's a professor of history at Southern Adventist University. There's a book called A Nation in God's Hands. It's a book about our church leaders' role in the anti-slavery and abolitionist movement. And in that book, Professor Lake is of the opinion that the reason Mrs. White wanted to move back east in 1863 was that she did not like the influence that the Civil War soldiers there in Battle Creek were having on her boys. They would muster and march. Her oldest son, Henry, was musical. He could beat a drum. He was a favorite among the soldiers. At one point, he had even confided to his mother that perhaps he would be a soldier when he got a little older. And I can't imagine Mrs. White would have liked that. In addition to that, in those soldiers, though they were gathering for a noble cause, they didn't all have noble habits. And so it was about August, almost September, that the Whites returned to the family home in Topsom, Maine. And as soon as they got settled in, James White wanted to make a trip to Boston to visit this man, Otis Nichols. Otis Nichols was a believer. He had been with the movement since the days of the Great Disappointment, and he had accepted the Sabbath. He owned a printing company. He had printed all of the charts, and this one over here is a replica of an early 1840s chart. He had printed all of those charts that the preachers had used. But now James White wanted a new chart. He wanted one that would include the three angels of Revelation, a picture of Jesus coming again, the sanctuary and the date, 1844. But it still would have those symbols from Daniel and Revelation and some of the timelines. And so James White ordered 100 of those charts to be printed. And he was going to pay for it himself. So he ordered them to be printed on paper. All of the charts prior to this were printed on linen cloth. The chart in the back of the room from 1902 is printed on linen cloth. But the plan for this one was that it would be printed on paper and then it would then be pasted onto linen cloth. And at the bottom there, where some of the paper is deteriorating away, you can see the linen cloth showing through. So James White, as I said, ordered 100 of those. And when they came in, he turned to his three boys with the chore of pasting the chart onto the linen cloth. I'm sure he must have showed them or described for them how to get the cloth wet and spread the paste and leave it out to dry. Well, the house wasn't that big, and it took a while for them to drive, so they couldn't do them all at the same time. I would imagine they might have done one or two a day or every other day, but they got started on that chore. Meanwhile, James and Ellen White started traveling around to the various Advent-believing, Sabbath-keeping congregations. They had a dear friend, a lady who lived next door, who was willing to help watch the boys so they could be gone. And before they had left Battle Creek, that church in Battle Creek had organized legally, and they had chosen the name Seventh-day Adventist. Here in Washington, they signed the charter 2 weeks later to be part of that legal movement. And so I can imagine that perhaps they were going around to the believing congregations, inviting them to be Seventh-day Adventists. Well, anyway, they went to Brookfield, New York. And while they were there, James had a very troubling dream. He dreamt that all was not well. Something was wrong at home, perhaps with the boys. He told Ellen about it. They knelt, they prayed, they waited. They went to the post office and there was a letter there waiting for them. Everything seemed fine. They discussed it. What should they do? Should they stay or should they cut their stay short? They decided they would hold the meeting they were planning to hold that night and then they would go home. And when they got home, everything was fine. The boys were glad to see them. Henry played a song on the pump organ in the front parlor, front room, welcoming them home. But the next day, there was an early snowstorm. A lot of snow was deposited on the main landscape, and those three boys did what children in New England do. They went out sledding in the afternoon. And they stayed out quite a while with that heavy bobsled, and I'm sure Henry, the oldest, put a lot of effort into hauling it up the hill, and maybe Willie, the youngest, tried to get a ride on it going up, and then they'd get on and have a grand slide down. And so it was quite a while that they stayed out. When they came in, they were hot and tired and sweaty. Henry took off his shoes and socks and his jacket, and he laid down in the front room against that pile of wet linen that was waiting for the charts to be pasted onto it. He fell asleep. He took a little nap. And as he slept against that pile of wet linen in the drafty house, he kind of took on a little bit of a cold. When he woke up, he didn't feel so good. A few days later, it moved into his lungs, and he had to go to bed. James and Ellen White prayed for their oldest son. I suspect they would have anointed him. But after a few more days, they didn't see any improvement, and Mrs. White had to have a serious conversation with her oldest son. She said, "Son, sometimes people who have this ailment do not recover from it." Henry White was able to reassure his parents that he was trusting in Jesus. He was able to speak words of encouragement and affection to the two little brothers. But after 2 weeks, Henry White died from pneumonia. He had made a request of his parents that if he were to die, would they please return his body to be buried in Battle Creek? He said, "When the Lord comes, I want to greet him with my little brother at my side." So he was buried next to the baby brother that was buried there the year before. Mrs. White wrote this in Life Sketches. "But oh, when our noble Henry died at the age of 16, when our sweet singer was born to the grave, and we no more heard his early song, ours was a lonely home. Both parents and the two remaining sons felt the blow most keenly. But God comforted us in our bereavements, and with faith and courage we pressed forward in the work he had given us, in bright hope of meeting our children who had been torn from us by death in that world where sickness and death will never come." Mrs. White did not write a lot about her oldest son's death. The story that I told you is not one that she wrote down. It was passed down through the family, and Arthur White, a grandson, was the one who wrote it down. Now, I don't know that laying against wet linen really causes a person to catch a cold and have pneumonia, but that is the story that is told in the family, and some of the details were also provided by a written account that the lady next door who helped watch the boys provided. I've been here when people from the Ellen White estate have pointed to this chart and said this chart is directly connected to the death of Mrs. White's oldest son. There were 100 of those charts that were ordered. They tell me today that there are only 3 that remain. Quite honestly, I don't know where the other 2 are. I know there's one at Andrews University, but it is in pieces in a box that they never take out. The people from Andrews, the people from the General Conference come here to see this one. So this is an original 1863 chart. I haven't told this a lot. I'm just getting used to this. On July 20th, 2023, last year, Andrews University visited here as part of the denominational history study tour. They were led by a man named Kevin Burton, who at that time was new to his position as the director for the Center of Adventist Research. While they were here, Kevin pulled my husband and I aside and said, "I've read that there were Black members of this church in the 1800s. Can you verify that?" I'd heard nothing about it. Ken knew nothing about it. He said, "Well," and he told us what he was talking about, and he sent us an article from the Adventist Review and Herald, June 22nd, 1966. It's an article by H.D. Singleton, and it's reporting on a meeting that they had in Detroit. They were discussing, I'm not sure what they were discussing, civil rights, the Black growth of the church, how we were going to deal with Black members, but it contained this sentence. O.O. Farnsworth is said to have observed that there were Negroes in the first SDA church organized in Washington, New Hampshire. O.O. Farnsworth was the son of William Farnsworth. He grew up here in this church. He was a missionary. He was a preacher. He was a church administrator. He died in 1947. And in 1966, somebody remembered that he used to say there were Black people who were members of this church during the Civil War years. And it got in the Review and Herald. And now Kevin Burton is asking, can we confirm that? Because this didn't seem like our church historians wanted to say this was reliable. I didn't know how to confirm it. I didn't have pictures of people. And so after annual meeting, we went to a meeting of the Washington Historical Society, and my friend Gwen Gaskell presented. And after the meeting, I went and spoke to her. Gwen is in her 90s. She has always lived here. Her stepfather was a member here in this church. And I asked her, "Have you ever known Black people to be members of the church down there?" She said, "We've never had Black people living in Washington until this year. There's one family that's Black that lives in Washington now." And I said, "Well," and I told her about Kevin making this request. And I went home thinking, well, that was a dead end. We may never know. But about 3 weeks later, we got an email from a man named Bill Mulcahy. He is a gifted researcher. He's a member of the Historical Society. He's here in Washington for the summers. And he emailed us that Gwen told him about this question. He'd been doing research, and he had some things he wanted to share with us. He invited us to his home on Half Moon Pond. We went. It was the Friday before Labor Day last year, so just about a year ago. We went and we heard the beginning of this story. Bill, who, by the way, has solved many historical mysteries and been featured on television for the Washington Historic Society, he went back through all of the censuses for Washington as far back as 1790. Now, I had not known this, but in the census, if a person was Black back then, they put the letter B after their name. He went back just looking, is there anybody who's Black that's ever lived in Washington? He found an entry for both 1860 and 1870. A woman named Louisa Phyllis, lived in the home of Moses Lowell and was listed as the housekeeper. Both years, there were some children who lived with her. Some had her last name and some didn't, who were also listed as Black. Well, that was interesting. We hadn't known that before. He did more research on Louisa Phyllis and found that she had come from Massachusetts. The Pepperell, Massachusetts census in 1850 showed that she lived with her family of origin in the poorhouse. Her parents had been born in Massachusetts after slavery had been outlawed, so they had not been slaves, but they had lived a life of poverty. Her father had been a cooper, which is someone who makes barrels, right? Yeah, okay. He then traced her when she left Washington. She went to Massachusetts, and she married a man named Elbridge Giger, who was Native American from the Hassanomisco tribe. This is where it got interesting because it appeared that he had some ties to the Seventh-day Adventist Church. There was actually quite a bit about him. And then Bill turned to us and said, and I finally found the answer to all of this. It's in your own Seventh-day Adventist magazine, the Atlantic Union Gleaner. We have a I don't know, what union are you from? Lake Union has a Herald. We have a Gleaner, okay? Now, the Gleaner's first year was 1902, and it came out every week, and you had to pay 50 cents to get it. And in the issue, the July 9th issue of 1902 of the Gleaner, was Louisa's obituary. Giger died June 20th, 1902 in Temple, New Hampshire. Mrs. Louisa Giger, and in parentheses it said colored, age 75 years. Many years ago, she did domestic work in the family of our esteemed brother, C.K. Farnsworth, that's Cyrus Farnsworth, William's brother, of Washington, New Hampshire. She became imbued with a love for the third angel's message, which followed her during a long life of toil and pain. Her husband was an Indian. He read the signs to her and the Bible. In doing this, he too found the Sabbath truth and embraced it. Her last years were full of suffering. Her disease, arterial gangrene, was a lingering one. A year and a half ago, she had one limb amputated, hoping to arrest the dire disease, but all in vain. When I visited her last, her hope for eternity was bright, and we trust she will come up in the morning of the first resurrection. Her aged husband mourns, but not without hope. It was written by P.A. Fish, who I suspect was a pastor at that time. In the 1870 census, Louisa was listed as illiterate. She could not read or write. But in the 1900 census in Massachusetts, she was listed as someone who could read and write. Our local historian, Bill Mulcahy, believes that she learned to read and write because her husband taught her, and what she wanted to read was the Bible and something called the signs, which I had to explain to him, signs of the times. I then was able to email Kevin Burton, and in the archives is the book that has the records of the Washington, New Hampshire Church. We now have a PDF of it on our computer, but in that book, it records that on September 21st, 1871, Louisa Phyllis was voted in as a member of this church. There is nothing in that book that indicates she was Black. We had to confirm that through other sources. In the local history book, Portrait of a Hilltown, I've talked about this several times in the appendix. The local historian makes the point that Rachel Oakes, the Seventh-day Baptist Sabbath keeper, who came here for the fellowship, even though she kept the Sabbath, she came here on Sundays for fellowship, she would not have been welcome to attend at the church on the Common, the only other church in this area, because of her Sabbath-keeping ways. He also says Joshua Goodwin, who came here and preached the Second Coming, he would not have been allowed to preach or even attend in that church because he believed in the Second Coming. And in their 1840 Constitution, they voted that only a certain type of preacher was allowed there, and the itinerant Advent preacher wasn't. I suspect in the Civil War years, 1860s, 1870, a black, illiterate housekeeper would not have been welcome at the church on the Common. But not only was she welcome here, she was made a member. And that's a legacy that I am thrilled to have learned about and that I am proud of. That has been written up in the Washington, New Hampshire Historic Society newsletter. Next month in the Atlantic Union Gleaner, I do have a little article that will be in it in the Northern New England section. And it has been passed on to our historians. We have verified one black member at this church. Were there others? We don't know. And let me just mention, this thing is taking on a life of its own. I haven't even told Kevin Burton this yet. Historic societies have read what this historic society puts out. Other New Hampshire historians are now researching and going back looking for black people that lived in New Hampshire during the Civil War years. And they are investigating where they lived, how were they treated, what did they do. And so this research that started here is becoming very interesting. So, cemetery tour? You know, as much as, and I'll start when everybody gets here, as much as I sometimes feel like our church started in legalism with having to keep the right day and having to be ready for Jesus to come, the more I research, the more I get a glimpse that they truly loved each other with Christian love.
Yeah. And they did it because they loved Jesus.
I think so. I do believe that. Yeah. Okay, Worcester Ball. Worcester Ball was a difficult man. He was a critical man. He would go on and on in the social meeting about what was wrong with everything and everybody. One thing Worcester Ball didn't like was a place called South Lancaster Academy, where the young people went away to school. And you know why? Jim Nix found a letter. As here in rural Washington, New Hampshire, every night, Worcester Ball ate his supper with a knife. Now, when they come from Andrews, they bring an example of a knife from the 1800s. It has a wide blade. And as soon as I start to tell this, New England people always give me a poem. I eat my peas with honey. I've did it all my life. It makes the peas taste funny, but it keeps them on my knife. The young people would eat their supper with a knife, and they'd go away to South Lancaster Academy, where they only gave them forks to eat supper with. And when they came back, they wanted to keep eating their supper with a fork. And that was too liberal for Worcester Ball. Worcester Ball also did not like the little lady that had visions. He was very critical of both James and Ellen White. He wrote a scathing article that attacked them that was published in a paper out of Michigan. And it really did say some pretty scathing things about them. Well, by 1867, this church had all but shut down. They were so discouraged because of Worcester Ball. They voted they would only meet when the pastor was there, and they didn't even want to have the social meeting anymore because he could go on and just be so caustic. Well, at that time, James and Ellen White were living in Battle Creek, Michigan, and they heard about what was going on with their dear friends here in Washington, New Hampshire. And they decided, along with Elder J.N. Andrews, to make a trip east. And so along about, I think it was September or October, They took the train from Battle Creek to Portland, Maine, and held a series of meetings there. They then took the train from Portland, Maine, over here to Hillsborough, New Hampshire. And by that time, there was snow on the ground. The brethren met them with horse-drawn sleighs. Mrs. White wrote that there were heated stones for her feet and heavy robes. And it was a comfortable ride until 5 miles outside of Washington, it started to sleet and the ice hit them in their faces. And that was rather painful. Well, they got settled in. They stayed at the Cyrus Farnsworth home and they started holding meetings. In the mornings, they would hold a meeting here in the meeting house. In the evening, they held their meetings over at the Farnsworth home. Brother Ball attended every meeting. The Ball farm was on Faxon Hill Road, the one that you came down to get to King Street here that we're on. At one point, Elder James White stopped the meeting and turned to Brother Ball and asked him to state his objections, which he did. And they labored with him. They prayed with him. They studied with him. And at one point, all Worcester Ball would say was, "Well, if things are as you say they are, then I'm in an awful lot of trouble." The time came for Elder Mrs. White and Elder Andrews to move on. They were planning to hold meetings in Vermont, but there was a heavy snowstorm. So they talked about it. Should they stay or should they go on as planned? They talked about Brother Ball. Mrs. White said Brother Ball was on the fence. He had not made a decision one way or another. And they decided to remain here in Washington until Brother Ball had made a decision. It was probably about 4 days later that Mrs. White preached a sermon in the morning about the sufferings of Christ on our behalf. Brother Ball had tears streaming down his cheeks. That night they went to the Farnsworth home, and Elder Andrews continued in that theme and told some stories of some of the early Christian martyrs. Again, Brother Ball had tears streaming down his cheeks. And at the end of that meeting, Worcester Ball stood to his feet and he said, "I know that I have been backslidden for a long time." He then went individually to both James and Ellen White and asked them to forgive him, which they did. That was in 1867. Look here at his stone. He lived until 1902. Do you know, at the time of his death, there were young people in this church who said they would remember Brother Ball as a kind and generous man. In the archives at Andrews University, one of the Farnsworth diaries of 1902, I believe it's Roy Farnsworth, it might have been Carol's, noted that he, as a young person, about 18, took turns with the other young people, sitting watch with Brother Ball as he lay dying, and helped to dig his grave. That need to criticize and put down was somehow tempered or changed. He was never afraid to give his opinion, but after 1867, something happened that the Lord changed his heart. William Farnsworth was the head elder of this church for over 40 years. He was the father of 22 children. Jim Nix used to always say, of course he was a head elder. That's a voting majority. He was the first to stand up in this church and say that he and his family were going to keep all 10 commandments, including the seventh-day Sabbath. The story is told that one night, Eugene Farnsworth woke up his teenage son, Eugene, from a sound sleep, said, "Eugene, I need you to get up and ride to Marlow for the doctor." Eugene was rubbing the sleep out of his eyes, and he said, "Oh, what's the matter?" His father said, "Your mother's going to have a baby." Eugene started to grumble a little bit. He said, "Oh, we've got enough babies around here already." To which his father said, But son, haven't you read in the Bible where it says, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth? To which Eugene replied, yeah, Dad, I've read it, but I don't think he meant you all by yourselves. In 1867, when James and Ellen White and Elder J.N. Andrews were here, Mrs. White had a vision that was a little bit different than most of her visions. There were a few like this in her prophetic ministry, where she had a vision with specific messages for specific people in a specific place. In other words, she had a vision with messages for the members of the Washington, New Hampshire church. She told the members that she'd had this vision and that she wanted to meet with them. It was a 5.5-hour meeting. Young Eugene Farnsworth was sitting in that meeting, listening to what she was saying to all the various people, and he had a thought in his head. If this lady is truly a prophet, then she'll say something to my father about his chewing tobacco. You see, William had told everybody he'd given it up, but Eugene worked out in the woods in the wintertime and saw the stains in the snow where he'd spit the tobacco juice. And no more had Eugene Farnsworth had that thought than Mrs. White turned to William Farnsworth and she said, the Lord has shown me that you are a slave to tobacco. But what is worse than that is that you have deceived your brothers and sisters into believing that you gave it up long ago as you promised. William Farnsworth, his wife Sally, Sarah, they called her Sally, was sitting by his side, cried tears of repentance. They both humbled themselves before the Lord and they recommitted themselves to him. And they did that with their children present. And their children were so impressed. They told their cousins, the Meads, about it. Newell Mead was brother to Sarah Farnsworth. And then Elder Mrs. White and Elder Andrews met with the young people. And there were 18 requests for baptism. 12 of them did not wish to wait until spring. And that's the year that they cut 2 feet of ice off Millen Pond. The other 6 young people were baptized in the spring. Jim Nix, who's retired from the Ellen White estate, told me that all 18 of those young people remained faithful to their dying day. Over half of them became preachers, teachers, Bible workers, missionaries, evangelists, conference administrators. So this is William's first wife. When she died, he married Cynthia Stoll. He was 48 years old. She was 25 years old. When he died, her sons, several of her sons had moved to Canada, and they were known for growing some special kind of corn there. And they came back for the funeral, and they invited their mother to come live in Canada with them. And so she, his second wife, is buried in Saskatchewan, according to the family descendants.
Yeah, I do some research. I'm related to them through marriage.
To the Farnsworths?
To Eugene.
Really?
Yeah.
There's lots of them. The Farnsworths were a founding family of Washington, New Hampshire. There were a number of brothers that William and Cyrus had. And they had a lot of descendants, too. So, yeah, there are Farnsworths all around New England. There are Farnsworths in Canada. There are Farnsworths on the West Coast. I don't know how they're all related.
Now, these are not original gravestones.
Some of them are, some of them aren't.
I mean, they look too brand spanking good.
Well, that's because if you had been here 10 years ago, they looked horrible. We have my husband researched how to clean them. It's a very gentle biologic that works with the rain and the sun. They are white marble, so you can't scrub them. Uh-huh. And he has cleaned them and sprayed them every year, and they get better every year, but they're about as good as they're going to get now. So, yes.
I was here with a group from Southern, 50 college students, and told
in the year 2000, and they didn't look anywhere near.
If you go over to that pile of brush, there is a fallen gravestone that has not been cleaned that is the same as these. We haven't had the money to have it re-fixed.
Yeah.
They used to all look like that.
That's what I remember.
Yep, right here. Newell and Sarah Mead.
Okay, folks, over here.
Right here.
Quick question.
Yeah.
This way, please. All these tombstones were facing this direction. This is the right.
Yeah.
Room.
No idea.
I didn't know you spoke German.
So they cleaned out on the other side of the wall this year and found two more places where stones have broken off. And there used to be stones there. And so we suspect there's graves over here that are not marked. We suspect there's people buried outside the wall, but we don't know who. Okay, Newell and Sarah Mead were much loved and much trusted. When the church was organized, Newell was selected as the treasurer. There are several stories that come out of the Mead family. In 1851, when James and Ellen White were here for the Sabbath conference, Sister Mead was unable to attend. She was sick. And so she wrote a note asking them to please come to her home and pray for them, pray for her. And so James and Ellen White, along with the pastor, Frederick Wheeler, and some of the local elders, went to the Mead home. They knelt, they prayed. Mrs. White dipped her fingers in the oil, and she anointed Sister Mead. And she wrote that Sister Mead was healed every whit. That reminded the Mead family of another need that they had. And that night, James and Ellen White were taken by rowboat across the pond. They were taken to the home of Brother Mead's sister and her family. And at that home, there was a sick child. They knelt, they prayed, they anointed the child. And the child was healed. Rosella Mead was their daughter. And in 1883, she would have been 25 years old. And I'm reading to you from the Washington Church records that are archived. December 25th, 1883, Sister Rose Mead, who had suffered for 13 weeks and was reduced in weight to 60 pounds and not able to turn herself in bed without help, was prayed for in harmony with divine instruction recorded in James 5, 14 and 15. Those are the verses that say, if they're sick among you, call the elders and anoint them. On the 25th of December, 1883, when she arose from her bed without human help, came out into the kitchen, and a praise meeting followed to the Lord for his divine power in saving the dear one from the power of death, and she began to amend from that very hour. That was written by Joshua Philbrick, the church clerk. And yet, I stand here near her grave because she, like us, is waiting for a Savior to come. Well, by 1867, when the church had become so discouraged and James and Ellen White and Elder J.N. Andrews came, by that time, Newell and Sarah Mead had stopped attending. Newell had suffered a fall from a ladder. He could not work. For all intents and purposes, he was an invalid. His wife was not well. She couldn't work. Their finances were in trouble, and they were discouraged. And as I mentioned, Mrs. White had had that vision. When she called the church members together, Newell and Sarah weren't there. And she said she really didn't wish to start that meeting without them, and would somebody please go get them? And so they hitched up the horses to the sleigh, and they brought Newell and Sarah Mead and settled them in. They were among the first that she spoke to. She did not speak words of rebuke. She reminded them that God loved them. And she said, even though it seems as though the troublous waters will overtake you, please be sure that he loves you and he has a plan for you. She then turned to them again and said, if you will but be faithful to him, he will bring you through the furnace of affliction purified. The Washington Church members cried tears of joy that day because their beloved Newell Meade physically appeared to be comforted and to be at peace, and they had not seen him like that in a long time. Okay, I had skipped over them for the sake of time. We did William. Let's do Cyrus Farnsworth. So these four stones right here, if you had been here even 10 years ago, this stone here is in three parts, and it was starting to tilt badly. A lot of our history books show pictures of it tilted. And friend Seth said to my husband, you know, another half inch and that thing's going to be on the ground. So they took some 2x4s and they braced it up. And then my husband stood up in annual meeting and made an appeal for money so that we could have this stone reset. We have a professional who comes out and does the cemetery for us. Most things to the cemetery. And so when he was here, he had to do some digging to reset the stone. And in the process of digging, he found these four stones buried under the soil. What I believe them to be is footstones. If you look over here at those two headstones, see the one with the crack in it? That's Daniel and Patty Farnsworth. Those are the headstones. And back here are the footstones. The only footstones that have survived intact in this cemetery are those two right there. Those were buried. I don't know if when they were done with them, they just dug a hole and threw them in. But anyway, right here on this one, it says JR. And on the other side, it says ER. Well, that's Emily Richardson, and on the other side of that stone is her husband, Jephthah Richardson. One stone for both of them. ZW over there is Zophar Wright. That seems pretty easy. JB, I would guess, is one of the Balls. It could be John Ball or one of the others. LM is a mystery to me. The Richardsons had a daughter. They called her Lucy M. She married Hosey Dodge, who we kind of skipped over his grave. I don't know if that's who it is. I've been all through here looking for an LM, and I have no idea. Anyway, Cyrus Farnsworth, his name is right here, was the younger brother of William Farnsworth. At the time of the Great Disappointment, he was a bachelor of 22 years old. But he didn't stay a bachelor long. He liked the young school teacher. The daughter of Rachel Oakes that was here in Washington to be the school teacher, Rachel Delight Oakes, they called her Delight, became the first Mrs. Cyrus Farnsworth. They had children, but Delight died. Her name is on the back of that stone. He married Lydia. They had children, and Lydia died. He married Harriet. They had children, and Harriet outlived him. And he still only had half as many children as his brother. His brother had 22. He had 11. The story is told before 1867, one of those times that Worcester Ball was going on and on in the social meeting about what was wrong with everything and everybody. Cyrus Farnsworth got a little tired of it. And so he stood up and he called out, "Worcester, enough. Sit down." But Worcester Ball kept right on talking. Cyrus Farnsworth started up the aisle, and once again he called out, "Worcester, sit down." Worcester Ball kept right on talking. Cyrus Farnsworth went right up next to Worcester Ball, put his hand on his shoulder, and with a little bit of pressure, one more time said, "Worcester, sit down." And Worcester Ball sat down. Every church needs somebody like that in your business meetings. Couple more stops here. How about that? I want to point out to you over here. Notice the date. As far as I know, this is the oldest grave in the cemetery. When they buried Olive, they fully believed they'd see her again in just 2 short years. The Great Disappointment was very real. Okay, one more story over here. This is the story that you only hear here. Our church historians don't consider this important to denominational history, but it's very important in Washington, New Hampshire. Waldo Farnsworth was the grandson of Cyrus Farnsworth. One day, and it was about 10 years ago, I was here. We had just built the pavilion, and the officers of the Atlantic Union were here. We'd had a wonderful Sabbath morning. They were walking the Sabbath trail. I was sitting under a tree in the shade because when they got done, they wanted a cemetery tour. And a car drove up, and a little old lady got out. And she came right up to me and said, "Could you please tell me, where's the grave of Waldo Farnsworth?" I brought her right here to it. Other people had asked me the same thing, but I didn't know anything about Waldo Farnsworth. Well, she started to tell me about Waldo Farnsworth. She said, "When I was a little girl growing up here in Washington, Waldo was a farmer. And every morning, he would get up and milk the cows, and he had an old model truck. And then he would take that milk on his truck and he'd make the milk run, deliver it all over town." She said, "Waldo loved kids, and all of us kids knew that we could have a ride on his truck anytime we wanted it." She said, "One time there were so many of us that tried to get on the truck that we tipped it over. And what do you suppose Waldo did? Do you think he yelled at us?" "No, he just laughed." And then she said, "Every day, Sunday through Thursday, we knew exactly what time in the morning Waldo would be coming through if we wanted a ride. But on Friday, we only knew that he'd be coming through early because he wanted to get done early so he could be home in time for the sun to set and the Sabbath to begin." Well, this dear little old non-Adventist lady is telling me what she knew about the Seventh-day Sabbath because she had known Waldo Farnsworth. So I started to do some research, and sure enough, the Historical Society had some articles written about him. There were pictures of Waldo Farnsworth, here's one of the earliest ones, with the children of Washington, New Hampshire, on his truck. These are the oldest people, the earliest picture. Jim Crandall, who's in his 90s, is in here. Bunch of others. I have since met many of the older people of Washington who have pointed out who they are in the various pictures. Waldo, as I said, loved children. He kept candy in his pockets. Some of the children remember that when they got to be 100 pounds, he would give them a silver dollar. He was a farmer. He was known for a special kind of white corn and potatoes. His garden was on the honor system. People could go in, put their money in the box, write their name down on the paper, or, you know, settle up at the end of the season or as they were able. And the last interview I did just about a month ago, a lady said how all the vegetables for the summer just cost a little bit. He was a musician. He learned to play the violin as a boy, and he found out you could make music with a violin bow and a saw. Do you know what I'm talking about? You've heard somebody play the saw? Good. A lot of people haven't. He would go out in his rowboat on Millen Pond in the evening in the summertime, and he would play the saw. This summer, we had a concert on the pond. Elder Merlin Knowles went out with his saw. We had some other musicians with him. This is only the second time we've done it in Washington. We had over 100 people, very few of them Seventh-day Adventists, and you don't get 100 people in small town Washington, New Hampshire. They were out. They loved it. You know, a lady, tears in her eyes, thanked me for the program in 2016, said, "I haven't heard music from a saw since I was a little girl and Waldo played." Waldo figured out a way that the children could have sugar on snow in the summertime. Do you know what sugar on snow is? Here in New England, we have whole church socials around sugar on snow. When you're making maple syrup, you take some of that syrup and boil it down even further. You get a plate of snow, pour it over it. It makes a wonderful sticky candy. Waldo would harvest ice from Millen Pond, keep it in the ice house, and he would boil down the sap to make syrup. And on overcast days in the summer, he would go to the neighbor's house. Jim Crandall and his brothers would run all around Millen Pond saying, "Waldo's sugaring off." The kids would come running with their plates. Waldo would take a tool. Jim described it as a saw blade, and he'd scrape the ice and give them snow on their plate and then pour the syrup over it. And they loved it. They absolutely loved it. Waldo was one of three brothers. He was the only one that remained in Washington. His two brothers went away as missionaries and preachers later on. But Waldo stayed here until his death in 1960. He was the last Farnsworth to live on the farm. And he left a legacy behind. You know, another thing, he'd go up in the wintertime with that truck. The kids in town would pile in. He'd bring them down to Millen Pond, where he had shoveled the snow off. He'd build a bonfire. My friend Gwen Gaskell remembers Waldo Farnsworth helping her lace her skates. The kids would go skating. They remember him so fondly here. We've done several interviews now with different people who remember him and the things they remember. And we enjoy a certain amount of goodwill in this town because of a legacy left behind by Waldo Farnsworth. The legacy of Waldo Farnsworth is this, you know, we're not all called to be missionaries and preachers, but we are all called to be good Christian neighbors. Well, this is a quiet little cemetery on a plot that doesn't even have electricity, on a road that goes nowhere. Nothing much ever happens here. But the day is coming that this will be a busy place. For the Lord himself shall descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of the archangel and the trumpet of God, and the dead in Christ will rise first. Then we which are alive and remain shall be caught up together to greet the Lord in the air, and so shall we ever be with the Lord. That concludes the cemetery tour. I'm going to make a suggestion for those of you that didn't walk the Sabbath Trail, that my husband could probably take you to site 31 so you could see that. It's the last site. It's right behind the church, and it's about the Sabbath in the new earth. If you're interested in that, you can go with him. If you want more stories in the church, I'd be happy to do that too.
We're doing permaculture on the Sabbath Trail, which is growing food in the forest for animals and people and building habitat that might be missing. And so Site 31 is our prototype. And we're taking three kinds of offering. Mm-hmm. One is money, because we don't know how much this is going to cost. We're just going forward. Two, we're asking people who have perennials that are deer resistant, shade and partial shade for the Sabbath Trail. And in the cemetery here, we're getting ready to add things here that are full sun. And then the third thing is, if you want to come and work and help plant those plants,
give us a call.
Give us a call. And we have had so many people tell us about things that we had no clue existed. This is becoming a parable of a body model church, because we have a structure that we've given to the people, and then they're giving me all sorts of things of what they can do within that structure. And so we can go now.
Yep.